Hello and welcome to this edition of the Unpacked podcast. I'm your host, Kieran Howells. And today we are talking about the increasingly complex position that FMCG suppliers find themselves in. Obviously, there is a myriad of factors currently impacting that role and position in the market. And so today I have a fantastic guest with me. His name is Ben Lewis, and we are going to break down what those key challenges are and also some of the ways in which FMCG suppliers can actually claw back some efficiency, some finance, and help with their bottom line. This is the area of expertise for Solytix, and we're going to hear a lot about what the company do, how they do it, and how they can more than likely benefit your business too. So I'm really looking forward to having a good chat with Ben. We will hear what he has to say right now. Let's go ahead and dive in.
I'm Ben Lewis. I'm the Chief Revenue Officer at Solytix.
Amazing. Well, it's great to be chatting with you, Ben. Been looking forward to this conversation. Right, let's just dive in at the deep end then. Okay. So I think it feels like FMCG suppliers are really being squeezed from every angle right now. You've got consumers who are resistant to price rises. You have retailers who are obviously very focused on protecting their margins. Suppliers are, I would say, stuck in the middle of that. So how would you describe the pressure they're under at the moment, and how are you responding to that?
That's a good question, and I think relevant to everyone probably listening to this podcast and even not listening to this podcast. Definitely we see a lot of pressure in our customer base. So the people, the businesses supplying retailers are clearly feeling a lot of pressure because of market conditions. I think that you make a point that is not lost on anyone at the moment, that you've seen particularly brands in relation to own label. There's been a sort of change, or there's movement in the market, and there's been some recent and quite interesting analysis about how own label products are actually on a par in terms of volume and sales to actually branded products, in certainly in the retailers. And I think that you know, that is definitely an interesting moment in the marketplace, because it traditionally it's brands that lead the way. They come up with the NPD. They're the people innovating and investing. And the idea that now certainly consumers are viewing own label products on a par with branded products, I think is a portentous, might be too strong a word, but it's definitely an interesting moment in, you know, FMCG kind of CPG, you know, grocery sales. I think that it is, you know, that to me is indicative of a marketplace that has seen a lot of change. And I think a lot of that change is coming courtesy of, you know, the inflationary pressures that we've seen. If you cast your eye back over the last sort of 6 or 7 years, I mean, it's just been one crisis after another. And I think the culmination of that is that you've seen prices rise significantly. You've got, you know, real inflation in the marketplace. And I think that is putting everyone under a lot of pressure. I think the way that Solytix helps a business like that, and the good businesses that we work with, is that those businesses understand what their priorities are, and their priorities are addressing and dealing with those prospective issues and actually how they're going to grow their market share, grow their sales, etc. And what those businesses understand is that if you're going to reconcile historic trading, which is not traditionally something that those businesses had necessarily have the time to do internally, outsourcing that to a professional, an expert with that capability, is a smart move. And it's a smart move in two really simple ways. One is you definitely take away potential time cost to your commercial teams. You might otherwise be dealing with historic audit claims from retailers. And two, you get the benefit of the money that is recovered where you have, you know, errors in promotional activity, or, you know, events that have not happened in the way that they're intended to, all of the jazz that goes on between retailers and suppliers. You know, you actually get the benefit of making sure those contracts have performed as they were supposed to. There's no rocket science in this. If you are feeling the pressure, your margins are under pressure, you're under pressure to grow volume, etc. You know, having that as an additional funnel into your business is just very useful to a business that's being pushed and pulled in a lot of other ways.
Yeah, but I think it's a really important thing that we address the elephant in the room. So what they, of course, may be very worried about is that the process of recovering those funds could damage relationships. Yep. It could, you know, it's a very, very delicate thing. So how do you go about that process without negatively impacting the company?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's a question that definitely rises quickly to the top in any conversation you have with a supplier. I think there's lots to unpick there. And I mean, we've seen Amazon being in the headlines in recent times for some of the wrong reasons, particularly around some of the GSCOP issues. But then you've got retailers that are making a real concerted effort to actually have to build stronger relationships with their supply base. And I think the bottom line is that I think good quality retailers want to have constructive working relationships with their supply base because they want them to invest in their businesses and they want to grow their businesses together. I think the important thing to think about with reconciliation is it shouldn't feel gladiatorial or confrontational. This is about evidence-based reconciliation. And I think retailers have conducted evidence-based reconciliation for the last 40 years or whatever the number is. I mean, this is not a new practice. So retailers will reconcile their trading with their supply base, and they will, where they find errors, they'll submit those those errors to their supply base and ask them to repay the money. The reason it's prevalent on the retail side is because if you're a retailer, you've got one accounting system and you've got maybe 5,000 suppliers. So for a forensic auditor, you've got one data set to process and then 5,000 audits you can do. The reason I think it's less visible on the supply side is that, you know, for Solytics, if we take on a customer, well, they might have 12, 13, 14, 15 retailers that they're doing business with. Every one of those retailers has got a way of transacting with them. So that's immediately you've got 15 data sets you've got to try and acquire and process. Then you've got the internal systems at the supplier itself, and they might have a legacy system, two legacy systems, whatever it might be. So you've immediately got a much higher, you know, cost of entry to do a supply side or a sales audit. So that's probably why this idea that, you know, forensic auditing that a supplier does, you know, that's potentially damaging. And then you've got GSCOP, which I think is the real most, is really fundamental to understanding why a supplier can now do a retrospective audit and not incur the wrath of their customer. So let's just recap. One, the retailers do it, and in doing it, they invite the supplier to do it. And actually, that was in the 2 year plus current provision that Christine Tacon introduced, I think in 2016, 2017. Which ironically was to protect smaller suppliers who are only getting audited maybe once every 4 or 5 years. Right. If you're a small supplier, you've only got a 50 grand or 100 grand business with Tesco, and you get audited once every 5 years, and the auditor finds 100 grand, well, then you're out of business. But if you're a big supplier who's getting audited twice a year, it's less of an issue. But one very clear sort of, you know, example of how presenting an evidence-based reconciliation to your customer, you're the retailer if you're a supplier, is we have a piece of best practice statement now called the Best Practice Statement on Forensic Auditing, which Mark White actually introduced, which Citics, you know, did some work on with him. And that basically sets out parameters about what a forensic audit or an evidence-based reconciliation should be and how that should work. And one of the things that it very clearly does is distinguish between, you know, retrospective claims, i.e. historic-looking claims, not being conflated with prospective trading. And I think that's a really critical, you know, sort of, you know, and all of the retailers that are subject to GSCOP have signed up to that best practice statement. So that really sets out, you know, this is what they're committing to doing, is not conflating retrospective audit claims with prospective trading, because you can see immediately how that's going to create a kind of, you know, a potential clash or potential problems. And, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm being arrogant about Solytics, but we set out in 2011, you know, 2012, we were presenting probably our first claims to retailers. And it was a real battle when we started to get retailers to handle our claims and to actually deal with them and not try and turn it into a commercial dialogue or whatever might happen. And actually through real perseverance, through using the CCOs at some of the big retailers, creating audit protocols and ways of working, we really created a framework that enables this process to happen as just another finance process. It's just not a contentious thing anymore. And I can say that because I've, you know, done the job from 2011 through to 2026, and I've seen the evolution of how retailers manage and process audit claims, and it's not something that is contentious anymore. So a very, very long-winded answer, but what I think I'm saying to you is I think suppliers always should be concerned about their customer relations because I think they're sacrosanct, but then they should come to a professional with the experience and who's actually understands that relationship, which I think Solytics are, and make sure you use the right resource to do what in your eyes may be a contentious or a, you know, something that has the potential to create a commercial conversation. Yeah, be really smart in how you decide to execute that and do it with people or use resources that really understand what that risk could be and actually how to mitigate it and how to do it professionally.
Mm. Just being completely nosy here.
Yeah.
What is the kind of average amount that you do see coming through?
It's a good question, and I've been asked that, you know, you do get asked that question. And what I don't want to do, because it's so variable, there are so many variables. How does what is the business of the supplier? What are they supplying to the retailer? What's the quantum of what's the value of the product? How many promotions do they run? But let's say you take a good quality British company that's got brands that you recognise on the shelf. You know, perhaps they're Sweet Treats or something that, you know, it's an everyday sort of purchase. If they've got a 13-month promotional schedule over the course of the year, 13 periods, sorry, not necessarily 13 months, you know, and let's say that their trade spend is, you know, anywhere between 20 to 100 million pounds, which would, you know, would probably fit within that category. You know, it's not uncommon if we do the reconciliation of one of the bigger retailers that we will find, you know, £250,000, £500,000. As an average, and that can add up to, you know, 10 claims, you know, at 25 grand or 15 grand or something. So that it's not, I think sometimes what I want people to remember is when you look at the overall quantum of the business, it's a small number. But when you're getting that money in and it's net money, and you're at that point in the year when you're a sales director and you're trying to hit your target, you know, a 50 grand pot, 100 grand pot, that is amazingly potent money to have in the bank, particularly when you've got all of those external pressures. And I think if people viewed it, this is a tool, you know, and actually it can serve my, but not be a threat to my commercial, but it actually can, because the other thing to think of, going back to your point on, you know, this threat, I'm always saying to people, you know, what are your leverage points with the retailer? It's always you have to tiptoe around them. But you've got leverage points too. You know, be smart. Understand what those leverage points are. Use those leverage points. If I find you a £2 million claim, are you telling me that's a bad thing for your business? Even if you don't realise the claim as a repayment, let's say that we've got mechanisms in our contract that allow the supplier, my customer, to utilise the benefit in whatever way suits them the best to avoid conflict. We're absolutely not trying to create a conflict here. So let's say you're a sales director and Solytics have found you a £2 million in your JBP, which would be very unusual. We have had a £2 million claim, but that's not happening every day of the week. It's
right, yeah.
It happens as an outlier. But imagine you've got that £2 million quid and it's valid. And okay, retailer X says, well, we're not going to pay that to you. Okay, well, now you can enter and negotiate. How are you going to realise that £2 million quid? Maybe we can factor that into next year's trading plan. And that's a really strong leverage point. It's
yeah.
so much better to know about that £2 million quid than to not know about it,
absolutely.
Which is what would otherwise be happening.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I think we've talked pretty well about the anxiety piece, maybe. The other thing that we've actually kind of talked about a bit off mic, and I think it's a really interesting point, is the to-do list, right? So the people that you're speaking to, we know they are harassed from every angle internally. The to-do list is gigantic. And you said something interesting about actually the fact that what you're offering is going to kind of deliver a financial pot there which would not exist otherwise. Why do you think that this isn't necessarily being pushed up that agenda? Because the sooner you're doing it, the sooner you're seeing a return on it.
I can answer that question really simply. You know, you asked your first question to me is what are the pressures that people are under? I mean, I think that the businesses, particularly in the food sector, but in a lot of, you know, consumer retail sectors are under is a lot of pressure from a lot of different angles. Technology, you've got AI, you've got the war in Iran, you've got oil prices surging. There's just so much going on. You've got all of the legislation that's floating around it's impacting on the food and drink industry in the UK. Mm. You've got, you know, the rollback of Brexit that is now being talked about, which is going to add additional burdens. There's a lot going on if you're in the sector. And I think, for me, if I'm, I've got a mid-level or a senior management job at a great British, a great British brand that's got a really top quality brand. When I think about what that individual will have as their day-to-day priorities, what's their performance being measured on? What are their KPIs being factored from? You know, what is their bonus going to be tied into? I can guarantee that not a single person in this podcast will have one that says, if you manage, to conjure up some money out of the 2024 trading, we're going to give you a bonus for that. That is categorically not what anyone is thinking about. And rightly so, because they've got this myriad of complex issues they're dealing with. So to answer your question, and this is an easy one to answer, that's the reason why. But, and this is the big but, isn't it? If you're a smart business leader, you've got a very special resource in someone like Slytics. You've got hundreds of years of accounting experience with people who have seen every single nook and cranny and bit of dirty laundry going in the market. There's not a single way of trading, storing information, processing information, you name it. A forensic auditor that's been in the grocery sector for over 30 years, that there is embedded knowledge in my audit teams that you just cannot replicate in any shape or form. I've got people working for me who have literally reconciled and analysed tens of thousands of promotions with every kind of data set you can imagine. That is, just try and compute the value of that kind of resource in today's world where actually oftentimes businesses are stripping out some of their embedded, sort of knowledge base. They're trying to replace things with new technology, etc. So it's, I think, it's really simple. If you really care about your business and your business's performance, even if Slytics don't find money for you, just having the benefit that you won't pay for, by the way, if we don't find any cash, of someone actually reconciling how you've traded and telling you, well, actually, the way that you change NAMs, you're not doing that in the smartest way. There's actually a much better way to actually do that transition process of perhaps swapping a team member, etc. And actually, we can tell you how to do that. That's just value added to your business.
Well, I'd like to kind of dig into a little bit that last point you made there. So how much of that challenge comes down to data quality? How much of it comes down to legacy systems, paywall data? You mentioned people moves.
Yeah.
What does the kind of the makeup look like here from your experience?
Again, you come back to just the day-to-day reality. I mean, you've got the CSR pages with all the shiny kind of corporate stuff on it, and then the reality at the coalface when you're, having difficult negotiations with retailer one and retailer two. And by the way, you've just been told that your cost of oil has gone up 25%. I mean, that's a lot of noise, right? And that creating a lot of pressure. I think that just the nature of the way that suppliers trade with retailers lends itself to a degree of complexity. You've still got human to human interface. This idea that AI or let's say technology can somehow, you know, if you've got two competing interests, the buyer and the NAM at the supplier, and they're both in a sense trying to win something out of a trade, you are not going to put that into an algorithm anytime soon and get an answer that both parties are happy with. Because AI just can't do that. You need people with all of the context and subtlety of how you trade, why I scratch your back here, why you scratch my back. I'll do this for you on a Thursday evening at 9 p.m. because look, you're my mate. Actually, we'll discount. That doesn't make any sense. It's a bit of a loss leader to us, but we'll do it because actually we're going to angle you up to do deal B over here and maybe we'll get a bit of extra margin. That's not programmable. So I think that, you know, you've got that whole human interface and all of the context, subtlety and complexity that comes with that. So I think that's the first reality. That's actually how the trading still gets done. And then, yes, you've just got, I think that you've got, you know, the whole, I guess this is not my area of specialty, but I think, you know, you look into the consumer marketplace, novelty and the speed of change now, influencers. You know, what are the young cool kids getting into next week? And actually, how do you be ahead of that marketplace? You know, that's a pretty complicated marketplace in terms of actually keeping abreast of the latest trends, the latest fashions. And I think you've been seeing over the last 4, 5, 6 years, companies really trying to evolve the way they market and present and, you know, what image they present to the marketplace and actually trying to keep ahead of those trends. So that they remain relevant to the consumer. Mm. So that's adding another layer of complexity. You've obviously then got the external events that we've talked about and which I think I've already alluded to. On the question of data, it's really interesting. There are some really interesting changes going on in the marketplace at the moment in the way that companies manage and interrogate data. And I think that you're going to see, you know, it's interesting in the sense that I can think of one retailer that's been going through quite a big transformation, which I think where they've introduced technology and actually it's led to some really quite poor outcomes, particularly around financial planning and forecasting, etc. So again, you know, there's a lot promised, but we're right in the nascent days, aren't we? It's just happening. We're just starting to see that the next transformation, the next exponential curve is taking off. But as at the beginning of that journey, I think it's going to be quite a lot of bumps as people really learn and understand how to use the technology and what's trustworthy and what's not trustworthy. And then, yeah, just coming into the food sector in general, you know, you think about how people have invest in those businesses and what they invest in. You know, a lot of companies have got quite old historic processes that sort of sit behind this facade. You know, and you'd be amazed that even in some quite sophisticated businesses, you kind of, once you drill down a few layers, you come to processes and practices and legacy systems that really aren't as sophisticated as you might think. They work and they do the job that they're required to. I mean, I think a good example, and I don't want to name any names, but one particular retailer that I have got some experience with, I think it took them 20 years to change their promotional system.
Mm.
20 years.
Yeah.
Because of, there's so much complexity in terms of how you manage an accounting system that is with all of those factors. Yeah. And again, been in the news recently, another very big retailer that we all know, they've had an absolutely torrid time trying to extricate themselves from one accounting system and create a new. And I think it's not that these companies are not competent or extremely good at what they do. I think that is complexity, though. You can't just turn the taps off. All right, we're going to shut shop for a couple of weeks. Don't worry, get everything sorted out, and then we'll be back and everything will be hunky-dory.
That's a
deal breaker, right?
Yeah,
so exactly. You're trying to do this while also doing all this other stuff and dealing with all of that. So, yes, I think data is a problem. And I guess on that piece, you know, data is also a commodity in the grocery sector. People build commercial insights. You know, you've got big companies out there that sell commercial insights to suppliers to help them make better financial decisions. So getting the right data is not always as straightforward as, well, I sold it, can I see the EPOS sale, please?
And, yeah.
You know, oh, yes, you can, but you'll have to cost you 50 quid to do it, you know. And so again, yeah, data is definitely is a big challenge. But there are some fantastic companies out there. You know, I can think of SKUTRAK, for example, that can really help businesses, you know, get a better handle on their data. So No, I think data is a really big problem. And obviously then time and just having the resource when your focus is very much focused on what's going to happen tomorrow, that's a, you know, whether you, no matter how, you know, how you want to play it, that is a challenge for everyone, which is, well, actually, I just don't have time to do that properly because I've got 50 other things that take priority.
You raise some really great and interesting points there that we could probably talk about for hours. But I think one of the most interesting is one of those kind of classic adages in the industry, isn't it? That actually the more historic the retailer or the more historic the supplier, there's a very good chance that their entire systems are hinged on one bad 1997 computer sitting in like
well,
a data
I live
center
in
somewhere.
North. Sort of northeast London, and I discovered to my sort of with sort of semi horror that there was. I lived quite close to the Walthamstow Wetlands, and on that in the Walthamstow Wetlands is a rather lovely Victorian pumping building. And I was reading something in I don't know the Hackney Gazette, you know, a couple of months ago, and apparently that pumping station is responsible for supplying water to something like 2 million households in the area that I live in.
Yeah,
but basically it's falling to pieces. But you know, how did it get to that state? How have you managed to get this one? Basically, it's tiny. It looks like a small pumping, old Victorian pumping station. It can't be much bigger than, you know, a sort of terraced house in terms of its actual size. Yet that one junction, literally, if that gets blown up or it stops working, 2 million people without water. I mean, that's going to be a national incident, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it's a really good analogy that you're using. I think, yes. And also people get custom and practice, don't you? There's certain businesses have a way of doing business. The business, you build up a culture over 20, 30 years, particularly if you're a well-established business. You try changing that. That is a very difficult thing to do. And I mean, Christ, the consultants, they're having a field day with, you know, culture change and transformation. I mean, I think probably the second most common thing that, you know, my customers say to me, apart from how much have you found me, Ben, is we're really sorry, but we've got a transformation process just about to start. And you're like, good luck with that.
Yeah, another one.
How many transformations? What am I missing here?
but it does say something that, I love the water pump analogy. It feels very like it's almost dark humour, you know, in this industry. But we are an industry where there is a lot of innovation. Yeah. And so it does feel like these layers are being added and added and added to these antiquated systems. So presumably that makes your job that much more complex.
It does. I mean, I think what you're alluding to is more the reality that this comes back to just time. You've got an antiquated system that works and then you transform it. That whole business suddenly is now trying to juggle two systems. You've not turned the taps off. The business is still running. All those pressures we've talked about. That is a real fug for anybody. You know, you are now really stressed. You were already stressed before. And you're desperate to get to the nirvana, the new system, but you've now got this period where you've got that a very painful process. And what invariably happens is even once the new system is in place, that legacy system reaches deep. You've still got to go back and interact with it. And, you know, that can go on for years. Literally for years. So it is a complex environment, but I'd say it's more complicated at times, and I think, it's about having the right resource. And in the perfect world, there would be time to do all of this stuff nicely and in a coordinated and organised way, but real life is not like that, because real life is actually the shoppers going to Tesco's tomorrow and they want to buy their whatever it is, and you've got to make sure it's there for them to buy. End of story.
So final question from me then for you. I like to conclude every podcast, if we can, with some actionable advice. Probably day one actionable advice, right?
Horsalytics.
But I mean, practically.
Mic drop.
practically, how do you start the process? What does that look like internally?
When you say start the process, do you mean how do you start approaching this issue, even regardless of whether you've got a third party helping you or not?
That's exactly it. How do you approach this issue? How do you start talking about it internally? Because obviously you probably need those advocates internally.
I think, well, what I know some customers do, particularly some of the bigger suppliers, is they've got audit teams. And I think that is that's not necessarily a bad place to start. And the reason, I think, not necessarily for the reasons that they think they're doing it, i.e. the benefit they're getting might not be quite what they think they're getting. But my absolute piece of advice to people would be is make sure that you have a way of distinguishing really clearly what is current and prospective and what is actually an issue that's retrospective. Because what we find when we come in to work for suppliers is that they can't tell you. If I say to them, well, how many audit claims have you received from retailer Y? How many did we? Yeah, we've had quite, I think we had a few, maybe six or seven, and they don't actually know. And as soon as you've got that reality going on, so you don't know whether you're actually dealing with a third party auditor versus actually an issue that's coming from the credit control team at retailer A. That to me, you know, if I could say the simplest thing to think about is just really have a clear separation so that you, if I ask you how many audit claims have you received in the last 10 years from all your customer base, you should be able to in 2 seconds say, well, I've received 62 claims valuing this. This is what the results are. And here are the claim packs and here's the evidence. You know, that would be a good starting point, because immediately you can see, as soon as you've got that separation, now you understand what the problem is. What is this thing? What are we talking about? Oh, it's this.
Yeah.
You know, these are the claims. What kind of claims have we received? You know, what kind of data are they sending over to support these claims? So, you know, that would be the most simple way I can answer that question quickly. You know, I suppose other prescriptions would be thinking about, you know, what your protocols are. You know, how do you store, you know, do you have a unified way of storing, do NAMs have a unified way of storing promotional activity? You know, they should do. Do you have a procedure in place about how you hand over, you know, between one NAM leaving post and another one coming in? Those are the sorts of very simple prescriptions that I think, again, can make life just easier. And make sure you've got a good email retention policy. You know, if your business does trading on WhatsApp, have you got a way of capturing WhatsApp conversations and making sure you've got them saved so you can refer to them in a year and a half's time? I guarantee you very few businesses will have that level of kind of storage, you know, capability or sophistication.
It reminds me of someone said to me recently that truly understanding the question you're asking is 60% of the way to getting to a good answer. And that sounds kind of similar to what you're saying.
I think that's too clever for me, but I agree with you. No, I think so. And again, you know, one of the challenges I find when I'm out trying to, you know, encourage people to give Slytics a go and to let us show them what they can do, is it's interesting because, you know, we effectively, you know, we're finding a pot of money for people, and we take a commission on what we find, so there's a benefit ratio. But very quick, I think, because the mindset in the industry is so focused on cost and the kind of, you know, this idea of I need to get the, you know, if I'm going to be a good, you know, buying manager, I've got to make sure I'm getting the absolute best price. So it's the cost of something, instead of thinking about, well, what am I going to learn or what is going to be the benefit from this service, the broader benefit. And I would say that, you know, that kind of that mentality can sometimes get in the way of actually allowing a business to think more, perhaps a bit more creatively about what kind of values that they may be able to bring into the organization by getting someone who's perhaps got a slightly different perspective or a, you know, a different experience base, actually feeding back to them and saying, look, you know, this is actually what, you know, we've had so many situations. I can think of one really nice customer of ours who we've worked with now 5 or 6 years, where they had a systemic, they actually just had a computation error in their form that they'd been using to do a particular type of promotion with one of their customers for as long as you can. And it was just literally the formula was written wrong. But that had cost them tens and tens of thousands of pounds over a long period of time. You know, and you know, these are clever people. They don't need me to show them. They could see that when we presented them and showed them where the error is happening. And that was purely just because of the way our auditor approached that particular, you know, transaction, because you're not looking at it with all of the experience base and then thinking about, you're just looking at it, well, what does this transaction actually do? And, you know, do I understand? And you try and work it out. And that revealed an insight that they been there in plain sight for all that time and they'd never seen. So, and I think that's real value added. It's very hard. How do you get that kind of value? Well, you get it by bringing in a different viewpoint and someone who can offer a different perspective. And I think that's what Slytics can do.
Perfect. Well, I think that's a perfect place to conclude, but it's been a real pleasure to speak to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure. Thank you very much, Kieran, for having me.
Well, that was a fantastic conversation with Ben there. Thank you so much, Ben, for coming on the show and enlightening us with all of your experience. If you would like to get in touch with Slytics, there is a very easy way of doing that. Just head to slytics.com and you can get in touch with them that way. But we hope you really enjoyed this episode, and we'll see you again for another one very soon.